This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The so-called laws of war have been breaking down. Civilians are often targeted, and that includes children. But children are not just the victims of war. They now are the perpetrators of war atrocities. Children are combatants in over three-fourths of the armed conflicts around the world. My guest, P.W. Singer, examines this disturbing trend in his new book, Children at War. He not only describes how children are recruited, abducted, and indoctrinated, he considers the implications for armies like our own, which have to figure out appropriate rules of engagement when the enemy is 12 years old. P.W. Singer is a National Security Fellow at the Brookings Institution and directs its project on U.S. policy toward the Islamic world. His previous book, Corporate Warriors, is about the rise of the privatized military industry. Let's start with the scope of the problem. What are some of the countries that child soldiers are used in, and what are some of the wars they've played a part in?
Well, the practice of child soldiers is far more widespread than I think most people realize. Around the globe today, children under the age of 18 are fighting as soldiers in more than 75% of the world's conflicts. So pretty much any conflict that we've heard about, from Afghanistan to Iraq to some of the lesser known ones in places like Uganda, see child soldiers in them. Another way to think about it is in quantitative terms. There's more than 300,000 child soldiers out there right now. Another 500,000 children are serving in armed forces that aren't at war.
Why would you, if you're a militia or a terrorist group or an army, why would you want to use child soldiers? I mean, they're not that strong yet because their bodies aren't fully developed. They're not that smart and aware because their minds aren't fully developed. And children can be very, like, rebellious and difficult to control. What's the advantage of using them?
That's the problem with this practice so far, is that actually the warlord leaders out there have really only seen the advantage side of it. While children may not be as physically strong, changes in weapons technology right now mean that for those weapons that are most likely to be used out there, light weapons, the AK-47s of the world, as opposed to, when we think of war, we often think of the most sophisticated weapons like jet fighters. But really, in most conflicts, it's the light weapons that are used. Children can be trained rather quickly to use them effectively. They may not reach the level of, say, a well-trained U.S. Army soldier, but with an AK-47, it's found that a 10-year-old can learn how to use it within 30 minutes. And the result is that this 10-year-old, with the new firepower and technology of these weapons, the new lethality of them, it means that 10-year-old can spray just as many bullets as, say, a Civil War regiment could in the same amount of time. Now, the organization leaders pull in these kids because they see them as useful. They pull them in because in some situations it may be that they don't have access to another labor pool. It may be because they have a cause that's not popular and they couldn't convince adults to join. And that's why you see a rise of a lot of these wars without ideology. For example, you know, conflicts in West Africa were more about controlling the diamond trade than any kind of politics side of it. And Colombia, it's the drug trade. So that's one way of doing it. Also, you don't have to pay kids typically. That's the reason that the FARC rebels in Colombia used them. They were facing, in a sense, a recruiting war with their adversaries. Their adversaries on the paramilitary side were willing to pay anyone $350 to join, $350 a month, whereas the FARC couldn't afford that, so they pulled in kids who were free. Kids are also more malleable than adults. They can be convinced to take on ideologies, fight with a fervor. In some cases, they indoctrinate them not just with politics, but they also maybe religious fundamentalism. In a lot of cases, they infuse them with narcotics or other things to make them more fierce than adult soldiers might be. They're willing to take risks that adult soldiers wouldn't be willing to take. So there's all sorts of reasons. And the troubling part of this is that so far these leaders haven't seen the downside of it. They've only seen the advantages of it. And probably the best case example of that was Charles Taylor. He was a self-styled warlord in Liberia. And he was a guy who was an escaped convict from Plymouth Jail in Massachusetts, went back home to Liberia. He invaded the country. He crossed the border with only 150 adult followers. His invasion was barely noticed. It was back in 1989. No one even really knew what was going on. But slowly he built up his force by abducting and tricking children to join it. And within a couple of years, he had a force that numbered in the 10,000s. And that force controlled what came to be known as Taylorland, which was this warlord domain, which did about $300 million worth of trade. A couple of years later, he became president of Liberia. He won the Civil War and became president of Liberia. So through kids, he was basically able to gain a kingdom.
We say that, you know, militia leaders haven't seen the downside yet of using children as soldiers. What's the downside that we're going to see more of?
Well, that's the challenge for us. The downside in terms of what it means for society, what it means for security, is pretty evident. It leads to more wars. Wars are easier to start because you can pull in a larger force. Because these fringe leaders that wouldn't otherwise be able to get recruits can convince them to join. A great example there is Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army, which is this group based in northern Uganda. Effectively, Kony thinks that he is the embodiment of the Christian Holy Spirit, and he's convinced about 200 adult followers that this is the case. He's been able to build up a force of more than 10,000 soldiers using child soldiers and fight a civil war for over 10 years. It's left over half a million people as refugees and killed tens of thousands more. So this is a guy who would be the equivalent of a David Koresh-like figure inside the U.S., but through child soldiers has been able to cause a civil war and fight rather effectively in that civil war. So it leads to more wars, wars that don't have the ideology. It leads to wars that are more tragic, not only in terms of children being involved, but also in terms of the atrocities that are committed in them, the human rights violations, violations of the rules of war, etc. And then finally, it means that wars are harder to stop, because just when you beat a force, just when you wheedle it down, if only a couple adult leaders escape, they can then reconstitute their force rather quickly by pulling back in more children. And so these groups that would otherwise die out are able to linger on. We saw that in Sierra Leone, for example, and we might be seeing that going on in Afghanistan right now.
One of the things that makes it possible for people to recruit or abduct children and make them soldiers is the fact that there are so many orphans around the world. There's so many people who have been orphaned by famine, by AIDS, by war. So how do the recruiters take advantage of the many orphans around the world?
That's one of the real tragedies here, is that despite the fact that we're living in probably one of the most prosperous eras in human history, at the same time we're leaving several groups behind. And that's not only in terms of the problems of globalization writ large, but also there are special at-risk groups, such as orphans, such as refugees. And within these groups, children are a major part. They're especially vulnerable for abduction raids because they're disconnected from society. They're disconnected from their families. The Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda is a group that basically has built up its force by abducting children from orphanages. But also, they're more apt to be pulled in by recruiting techniques that effectively tell children that this is their only opportunity to protect themselves, the only place that they can get a safe environment, have a gun in their hand as opposed to the chaos around them. It's a place where they can get a square meal. It's a place where they can be a member of something rather than on their own. All sorts of ways to trick them.
I guess they have very little to lose.
That's one of the other parts, is that they feed in to children's gullibility, so to speak, and tell them this is the way not only that you can become a man, avenge what's happened to you, take a part in society rather than being on your own, but also in some cases saying, look, you've got nothing else to lose. And that's particularly terrorist groups have used this as a means, saying, your life now is so horrible. Think how wonderful it will be in the afterlife if you undertake these operations.
If you're just joining us, my guest is P.W. Singer. He's a fellow at the Brookings Institution, and he's the author of the new book, Children at War, which is a book about child soldiers around the world. One of the many upsetting things about this, I mean, there is an ethic in I think most cultures that you protect children, and that, you know, adults are often willing to risk harm to their own bodies to protect children. But I'm wondering if you think that children are used as cheaper life than the adults. If the adults protect themselves by putting the children in the front lines and having children take the most risk. If the children are in fact considered even cheaper life than the adults in the militaries are.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely a problem. And there's really two things to say about that. The first is when we look at human history, when we look at the history of warfare itself, over the last four millennia, the rule held that children had no place in it. They had no place in it as targets. They had no place in it as participants. It simply was not allowable. Now, there were violations of that, but there wasn't this practice, this global practice that we see going on right now, where you're seeing children targeted. More than 500 children have died every single day over the last decade in warfare. And at the same time, they're acting within war. More than 300,000 children are serving as soldiers. So we're seeing that rule change, and part of it is because we're looking at children differently in the context of war. That's the reality right now. That's the dark reality. And within that, certain groups do use children because they view them as cheaper, easier recruits. They see them as a way to spare the lives of their considered more valuable adult soldiers. And you can see the way they deploy children on the field, and everything from human wave attacks to there are certain groups that use children as live landmine detectors. Basically, they send kids down the trail first, and that's the way they find out if there's a mine there. To, in other situations, they put children out at the checkpoints while adult leaders hide in the bush. And it's something that when we're facing these forces, we have to be aware of. This is the new nature of 21st century conflict, that there are children involved. And so we've got to shift our reaction to it.
Let's talk a little bit about how children are transformed into soldiers and what the indoctrination and initiation process is like. First of all, what are some of the things they're put through so that they learn how to kill and that they feel comfortable taking another life?
Well, they never feel, I don't think, comfortable. It's just part of a broader change in identity that these groups try and enact. And what's interesting and disturbing is they often have their parallels to the way we indoctrinate people into different organizations like armies or gangs, even fraternities, those sorts of things. And the most disturbing aspect of it, which happens, is when they force the child to kill very early on. It's meant as a breaking point. And you see these most often in abduction raids. And for example, I met a young child soldier from Sierra Leone. And basically the rebels showed up at their village, lined everyone up, shot some people, and then forced the kids to take part in the killing of another, of one of their neighbors there. And they held them at gunpoint and said, "You kill this person or we'll kill you." And the first kid that balked at it, they shot him. And every other kid then said, "You know what, that's what I've got to do." And these kids then described it as the turning point when they crossed into another identity. Once they'd done that, not only were they anathema to their home village, they felt they couldn't go back again, that everyone knew that they had killed and killed someone within that village, but also that this organization was made up of people like them. And so even though they didn't believe in it, they felt they had nowhere else to go. Other groups will use techniques like shaving the heads of kids, all the kids who immediately join. And it's a way of, much like we see with boot camp, it's a way of creating a new identity and also making it harder for those people to return. They stand out in regular society. Branding is something that happened. For example, also in Sierra Leone, the RUF there did this, where it would basically brand the letters RUF, which stood for the organization, the Revolutionary United Front, and they would put it on forehead, shoulders, etc. And so these kids would stand out and they would say, "Look, this is a group that's hated back home. That's why you can't go again. You're part of us."
You know, I've talked to many reporters over the years who've covered civil wars and regional wars, and I've heard often about encountering children with automatic weapons who are high. So you're not only dealing with facing a child opponent, but also like they're addled by virtue of being high on whatever the local drug of choice is. Is that something that you think is part of the process of getting them to do the job?
It's definitely something that these groups use. It's seen really as a tool to complete the training and indoctrination. And the drugs that they use can be anything from heroin to cocaine to there's different mixes that you'll see. Some it's even a mix of cocaine and gunpowder that's packed together. And what happens is usually the kid is forced in the first part to use the drugs, put at gunpoint or even held down, and a slit is made on the arm and it's packed in. But then very quickly addiction sets in. And there's two things here that take place. The first is when they're on the drugs, the kids, the sense of reality is changed. And so it all becomes almost, they've described it as being disconnected. It was as if someone else was out there fighting. And so the things that they were doing, it wasn't them, and the risks that they were facing, they weren't really seeing them. And then the second part is it's another way of creating dependency on that child soldier force, because now it's a physical dependency. If they leave, then they're in effect breaking that line of addiction. And so it's another way, it's another tool that these groups use. And then the legacy effect of that is obviously really terrible, because even when the war ends, you have this mass of adult kids that not just are scarred by the experience of being child soldiers, but also in many cases have drug addictions.
Let's talk a little bit about how we got to this point. Society's always had prohibitions against children fighting, and that was good not only for the children, but for the culture as a whole. You say that the first modern use of child soldiers was in the 1980s during the Iran-Iraq War. What did Iran do to break this taboo and start recruiting children or encouraging children to join the military?
At the time, Iran was fighting a losing war against Iraq, and it faced a disadvantage in terms of technology, and so it responded by trying to amp up its quantity versus the quality side. And even though it was a supposed Islamic republic that was guided by Sharia law, it actually violated that law and declared, and at the time it was Ayatollah Khomeini, declared that anyone as young as 12 could join. And then they set up a rather sophisticated recruiting program to pull in young boys as young as 12. And they would recruit in the schools and the like. And one of the things that they did was promise that anyone that did join and died in the battle would have an immediate entrance into heaven. And actually, they would give the kids who joined not just a weapon and a couple grenades, but also a key to wear around their neck, because it was the key that would unlock your way to heaven. And they used these kids in a way that was pretty much seen as cannon fodder. They were to advance first and break up the minefields, serve as extra targets, etc. And it was expected that most of them would die. And so the losses were rather high. Then one of the worst parts of it, which indicates that really they did intend for them to die, is that a small percentage were captured, around 1,000. And so at the end of that war, the Red Cross said, okay, do you want these prisoners back? Do you want these former child soldiers back? And Ayatollah Khomeini commented on it that these captured children, these are not our children. Basically, that our children were the ones who died, the ones who were captured. We want nothing of them.
So what happened to those children?
Many of them ended up being refugees and sent around the world to finding asylum across Europe and the like.
Okay, so Iran played a big part in this trend of child soldiers. Iraq played a part too. What did Saddam Hussein do to mobilize child soldiers?
After the Gulf War, the regime faced a real problem, a crisis of legitimacy and a crisis of forces. And one of the ways it answered that was creating a whole system designed to build up child soldier forces as a way to pulling them in the regular forces. There were summer training camps where basically kids would spend up to 3 weeks getting political indoctrination, but also learning how to use an AK-47 and the like. The real backbone of it was a special unit that was created called the Ashbal Saddam, Saddam's Lion Cubs. And it was for boys between the ages of 10 to 15. And it was almost like you could think of it in terms of an equivalent of the Boy Scouts, except aside from, you know, the regular type of community, they would also learn how to use weapons, they would get political indoctrination and the like. And it was intended as a feeder organization into what was the Saddam Fedayeen. This is this paramilitary force that was led by Saddam's son Uday, that during our recent invasion, it was the Saddam Fedayeen which was the one that actually fought back, as opposed to the Iraqi army. So they set up this whole system designed to train and indoctrinate children.
You know, your previous book was about private military corporations. So, you know, your previous book was about mercenaries and corporations that are now involved with war. And the new book is about children who fight in wars. And so reading these books back to back, it just feels like everybody's getting into the act. Everybody's at war.
Well, I think one of the ways to think about it and what motivates me is that I think we've got it wrong when we think about war. When we think about war, when we say the word war, the image in our heads is of men in uniform fighting for the political cause of their nation state. And the reality of warfare in the 21st century is it's not like that. It's men, it's women, it's children, and they're fighting in organizations that range from armies, rarely now, to warlord groups, drug cartels, terrorist groups, you name it. And the causes they're fighting for are rarely political in nature. They include economic causes like these corporations and the like, but also like these warlord economies that are really about, you know, drug trade, diamond trade, you name it. It may be religious causes, social causes. It may even be for no cause at all. Some of these, the child soldiers are in it because they've got no other choice. And so warfare is messier, and a lot of people would describe it sort of postmodern. And that's what we have to own up to, is until we understand the way it really is, we can't respond to it properly.
Are U.S. troops facing child soldiers in Iraq now?
Yes, and far more extensively than anyone's been willing to talk about. As the insurgency grew, child soldiers were seen as a pull for it, and are seen as a pull for it, and pulled into it. And perhaps a best indicator was the fact that the same week that President Bush made his mission accomplished speech in the aircraft carrier landing, that same week, an Iraqi 12-year-old shot up a U.S. Marine force in the city of Mosul. And since then, the use has grown and grown and grown, and they range from child sniper incidents to an Iraqi 15-year-old that tossed a grenade into a U.S. Army truck and blew off the leg of an American trooper. What's worrisome is that the broad insurgent forces that we're facing, each one of them has started to use child soldiers. The former Ba'athist forces, the old Saddam loyalists, they're trying to tap into this old network of Ashbal Saddam groups. It's also taking place in the Sunni triangle, including, for example, the fighting in Fallujah last November. Saw U.S. Marines fighting what they described as children with assault rifles. And then also even in the Shia sector, for example, Muqtadar Sadr is this radical religious cleric there who led an uprising against us, and the fighting was particularly fierce in the city of Najaf. He openly talked about how great it was that they had child soldiers. And in the book, there's some pretty disturbing quotes from some 14-year-olds and some 12-year-olds about their experience of fighting U.S. forces.
The questions this poses for U.S. troops, I guess, is also being faced by other armies around the world. I mean, American troops want to think of themselves as being where they are to help children, among other things, and to protect children. You know, our favorite images are of GIs, you know, in World War II giving out chewing gum and stuff to children. And now they're in a position where they don't know whether the children are going to shoot them or not. And so what kind of instructions do American soldiers have about whether to shoot children who seem to be soldiers?
It's perhaps one of the toughest dilemmas of this doctrine, the fact that soldiers face very real threats from a foe that they would rather not do harm to. Simply put, a bullet from a 40-year-old kills just like a bullet from a 14-year-old. At the same time, though, you're facing a child, and no soldier wants to be put into that situation. The worst part of it, and this is one of the things that the book is arguing, is that U.S. forces right now don't have this type of intelligence preparation, training, doctrine, equipment, etc., to give them that kind of support. And I'll give you a pretty pointed example. Last year, U.S. forces were ready to deploy into Liberia, which had a civil war that was going on there. And there was a Marine unit that had 2,400 Marines in it, and they were right offshore. They were about to go into an area that had 60% child soldiers. And I ended up getting an email from one of the officers in the unit, and he said, look, we've been reading on the news reports that this area we're about to go into has 60% of child soldiers there. We've gotten no preparation, nothing about it. Can you help us out? And so I ended up sending them, I emailed the draft of the book to them. That's not the way it's supposed to be. That's just simply not the way it's supposed to be. And so just as our forces have had to change to and their training for 21st century warfare, dealing with more urban environments, the fact that we're not facing armies that use tanks anymore, but they're insurgents. Another part of this is the fact that the adversaries out there are very likely to be children. In fact, it's almost inevitable that they will be children. And they have been children, and we've got to own up to it.
So once you sent the advanced copy of your book, do you think it accomplished anything? Was it helpful? Did you hear back from this person?
I hope so. Yeah, I mean, they were thankful for it. And actually, the Marines have been one of the more progressive organizations looking at this issue. For example, they held a conference at Quantico on the child soldiers issue, and the speakers at it included myself, a former British military officer who'd faced child soldiers in West Africa, to a former child soldier himself. And so the Marines looked at it and said, look, this is one of the ways that warfare is changing, and we need to catch up to it. Unfortunately, it hasn't been integrated into the broader training doctrine, the war gaming, et cetera, the equipment, you name it. It was really just a small conference that was held. Gee whiz, isn't this interesting?
We say the United States doesn't really have a policy yet. They haven't thought through how to handle child soldiers. Are there any countries who have?
Not holistically. There's different countries that have built up different experiences and deal with different aspects of it quite well. For example, some countries have very good programs in terms of how they do rehabilitation. You see that in the Philippines or in Colombia. In other countries, the type of support that they give to their troops afterwards are quite good. We also should be willing to learn from the mistakes that others make. And one of the things that's worrisome is that we haven't been willing to do that. Not only do we not look at the experiences that our allies have had, for example, the experiences that the British Army had in its operations in West Africa, a lot of them that didn't go quite well with child soldiers. There was one that the book talks about where a British Army force was taken hostage by a child soldier force, and they had to launch a rescue raid, and all sorts of things happened from that. There's other armies that we don't typically work with that have a huge experience. For example, the Sri Lankan army has been fighting the civil war for almost 2 decades and have built up a wealth of experience. So it's one of those things that we should be willing to learn. But really, at the end of the day, it's about facing up to the way war is rather than the way we wish it was.
You know, just one more really frightening thing about the tens of thousands of children who are fighting in these wars now. If all they've known is violence, and if they have been fighting from the age of 10 or 11, then how do they get to the point? How are they given the opportunity to develop any empathy or, you know, feelings with other people? And is it possible to learn that after years of having killed people? I mean, can you ever become, you know, fully human and social again? Are we going to be surrounded in the world by the grown-up version of the child soldiers who never learned the meaning of empathy?
It's one of the abuses of this practice that normally doesn't get talked about, and really it's the destruction of childhood itself. And the worry about that is that this is a period in our lives where your identity is shaped and your whole sense of right and wrong is shaped. And so that's one of the worst abuses of this. So the challenge of these children after the conflict is that they face huge issues in reintegrating. That can be everything from finding their families to the psychological scarring, the physical scarring and ailments that have been dealt to them, basically lack of vocational opportunities, you name it. And so the programs that help them, they're everything from these camps that basically offer them, you know, just a safe place to get away from it all, to there's some very great programs that do things like help them catch up in their schooling, to programs that help the local society reintegrate. For example, there's a radio station in Sierra Leone that's not only designed for kids to listen to, but also is run by former child soldiers themselves. So there's a lot of these programs out there. The problem is they're almost all under-resourced, and they're not as widespread as they should be.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me to talk about this important issue.
P.W. Singer is the author of Children at War.